Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Governor Cooper puts the brakes on reopening, delaying the start of Phase 3 till mid-July and mandating masks be worn in public. If you live here and plan to travel to New York, New Jersey, or Connecticut, also plan to quarantine when you arrive for 14 days. Gunfire erupts at a block party along Bates Ford Road. Despite fatalities, very few people have come forward to help people find the perpetrators. Changes at CMPD, changes coming to the names of some area high schools, and expect changes at NCDOT. And here to update us on all of that and more is Glenn Birkins, founder and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Good morning. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
Nick Oxner is WBTV's investigative executive producer. Good morning to you.
Hello.
Eric Spanberg is the buffer between you and our next guest. Eric is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good to see you again.
Good to be a buffer.
And and the reason for the buffer, Joe Bruno is here, reporter for WSSC-TV Channel 9, Eyewitness News. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
A reminder that Joe and I have actually been friends for like a decade.
I know. It makes for better radio if I have foes on the panel. A lot of people and a lot of businesses were eagerly awaiting a move to the third phase of our economic reopening, but the coronavirus wasn't having it, and neither was Governor Cooper, who delayed that move until July 17th because the numbers are going in the wrong direction.
The numbers we see are a stark warning, and we must pay attention. I'm concerned. As we've watched and studied and dissected these numbers in recent weeks, that concern has grown. Since the beginning of this pandemic, I have been clear that data and science would lead the way. In following that standard, it's clear that our numbers will keep us from moving ahead into the next phase of easing restrictions.
And with that, he extended phase two to July 17th. That's another 3 weeks, I think. How big a blow is this to businesses and to workers? I'm not sure who to ask. Well, Eric, you're the business guy. How big a blow is this?
Well, I mean, you instantly heard from business owners their frustration, particularly the businesses that have not been allowed to open, obviously. So you have the bar owners, you have people who own gyms or run fitness centers, obviously, you know, any kind of entertainment venue, large scale entertainment venue. All of those workers, owners, executives are frustrated. They were looking to June 26th today, obviously. You know, as recently as a couple of weeks ago, the governor was still saying he floated the idea of a phase 2.5, you know, sort of an early expansion of what we had in place. And now it's gone to this. What's interesting about that, Mike, is the numbers have been bad all along. There was never really any positive blip or trend in these numbers since we have gone into phase two. So when you look at it from that standpoint and you hear him talking about data and science, he really had little choice but to do what he did.
And what is becoming apparent is this is happening all over the country. I think Texas's governor also stopped their progression of re-entering the economy just yesterday. I think Florida has done it, or at least the cases are rising in these states. And when you look at the graphs that you see on TV now between how what's happened in Europe and what's happening here, it's as though we just ignored this virus. They got it under control. What did they do that we didn't do?
Testing. The thing all comes down to testing and a lack of testing, both across the country. We know there was a failure by the CDC to properly develop a test early in the pandemic nationwide. And then in North Carolina, the problem is we did not ramp up testing fast enough. And so because you don't have testing, you don't have the ability to isolate people or identify the virus. We still have, in some respects, limited access to testing here. And until you have adequate and ample testing and contact tracing, you cannot properly control the virus.
Testing was certainly a huge part of it, but there's another part as well. In Europe and China, naturally, I think the people were much more willing to abide by isolation, social distancing, things like that. in the United States, we just have a tradition of being rebellious. We don't like government to tell us what to do. We like to go where we want to go and do what we want to do. And I think that has hurt our ability as a country to kind of come together and take this thing seriously.
It also became political here. I'm not sure that it became as political in the European Union. Do you want to comment, Joe?
You know, what's interesting. The New York Times did an article and they interviewed health experts in other countries. And there was someone in New Zealand who was like, it looks like the United States just gave up. What is going on over there? How is it still getting to this point? And my question for the governor on Wednesday was, like, how did North Carolina get to this point? Is it testing and tracing, or is it people just not being responsible? And I asked him this question. He refused to answer it both times.
But that's my next question, because we're one of the hot spots in the nation. For a while, we were kind of floating in that area, but now we're definitely one of them. And our numbers continue to rise in terms of both the number of infections and in the number of hospitalizations. Do we understand why us? What are we doing or not doing?
No. And the biggest problem here is that DHHS is blocking access to data that would allow us to know that. And WBTV is part of a coalition of 27 media outlets suing for access to an anonymized database of that information.
Why are they blocking the data? Why?
They claim that it's protected by federal patient privacy laws, which wouldn't apply because you could release it without names and identifying information in it. We've been trying to get access to this since the start of the pandemic in late March. And DHHS is blocking access to a bunch of other data that would allow us to expand that as well. But Mike, what we do know is that the virus has spread particularly prevalently in nursing homes and other long-term care facilities, in meatpacking and other manufacturing plants where the environment for the virus is easier to spread, and amongst prisons. And what we also know is that testing has been limited in each of those facilities. In fact, there is more news this week that all nursing home residents were supposed to be tested, and that still hasn't happened. It took a judge to order the prison system to test all of its inmates. And so the places that we know are at greater risk for spread of this virus are doing the least amount possible to stop the spread of the virus.
There are two other things. One is Secretary Mandy Cohen said this week that they're having shortages again in terms of having the supplies to process tests. That's obviously not good. And then the second thing, Nick, I would add to your list is, particularly here in Mecklenburg County, when we look at the Hispanic cases, I mean, it's still up 38-40% of the cases are Hispanic people, and they are only 13.6% of the Mecklenburg population. I mean, this is just a huge problem. I know they've taken some steps to try and address this, but obviously that's an area where we have to do better.
Glenn.
That's a huge problem. But I think another narrative that's playing out, not just nationally, but here as well, we're seeing more young people who are testing positive. And the county, at least, believes that that correlates with the fact that we're not social distancing anymore. We're not, or as much as we did in the past. Their evidence points to people not taking this pandemic as seriously as they once did. And I think that fatigue is starting to play a role in the resurgence too. People simply want to get back out there.
You've all pointed to testing and a lack of testing being part of the problem here. The president seems to be convinced that, at least he's telling his audience that he's convinced that testing just leads to more cases. And he told his people in Tulsa that he told health officials to slow down the testing. They are now trying to backpedal on that at the White House. But just so people who are listening don't believe that testing is only something that reporters are talking about, the need for testing, that's not true. We had earlier this week Dr. Cameron Wolf, an infectious disease specialist at Duke University, on the program.
Leaders and politicians can say what they will about the number of tests being run as a measure of, like, skewing the statistics. But the hard fact is that we would not have 900 people admitted in hospitals here if we did not have more disease spreading.
And they're saying now, health officials are saying now that the number of cases that we have may actually be 10 times what the testing is indicated because we're not doing enough testing. We have over 57,000 cases in the state. We've completed about 811,000 tests. So 90% of those being tested test positive for COVID-19. And contrary to popular belief, as you mentioned, Glenn, it is young people who are most affected. Here's Mecklenburg County Health Director Gibby Harris.
The majority of our cases have been in individuals between the ages of 20 and 59, and that has been consistent from the very beginning. Right now, 43% of our cases are between those ages 20 to 39, and 30% of our cases between 40 and 59.
And she's confirming what I and probably you have noticed anecdotally just by going out to pick up groceries or going out to pick up food at a restaurant or whatever. You see a lot of you. I went into a restaurant to pick up food the other day. There were 10 people sitting at the bar. You can't drink with face masks on, but nobody had a face mask on, and nobody had a face mask anywhere that you could see. Maybe they had it in their pocket. Is it that young people think they're impervious? Do they think this is a disease for old people? What are they thinking?
Here's the problem, Mike. We don't know necessarily that that's what's causing the spread of the virus. Now, maybe it is, and in all evidence. But again, if health officials could release some actual data, we might start to have a better idea. Keep in mind that, people under the age of 17, the number of cases under the age of 17 has doubled in recent weeks. Now, we don't know, is that parents who have to go to work and get the virus at work, bringing it home? We don't know. Or is it, Joe and his buddies going out on Plaza Midwood for a drink?
It's Joe and his
buddies. We don't know what's spreading that. Now, should people be drinking at bars without masks on unnecessarily? No, drink at home like a normal human. It is dangerous when we get into the speculative territory, and I would challenge state health officials and local health officials to release more data that could be released so that we can actually know where these cases are coming from.
Joe.
I think this is true for all ages, though. There is coronavirus fatigue, which is, not good to have since we don't have a vaccine or a cure or anything, but there is fatigue. And as far as not wearing masks out, I do think the fact that there wasn't some sort of standard or some sort of guideline that all bars and restaurants have to follow played a role in the fact that people aren't wearing masks to these establishments. Now that we have the mandate in effect, the rules, or at least the guidance, is more clear. They want you to be wearing a face covering anytime you are not at your table. I think people, at least more people now, will listen to that and put that into practice.
We're going to talk about face masks in the next segment here, but remind people, since we're sticking around and we're staying in phase two, what are the restrictions attached to phase two?
Well, it's 50% capacity. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, we don't have a stay-at-home order, so you're allowed to be out and about, 50% capacity. Restaurants can open for in-person dining, and, some restaurants serve as bars as well in the nighttime hours, so there is a loophole there that allows people to go there and get drinks late at night. 10 people for indoor gatherings, 25 people for outdoor gatherings.
Can restaurants hold on 3 more weeks? I know that it was announced, I think yesterday, that Upstream in Phillips Place is not going to reopen. They join a list of restaurants that are gradually saying we can't make it another day. Will a lot of people have to throw in the towel in the next 3 weeks, do you think?
I do think so. And some restaurants are actually turning to GoFundMe now, saying, hey, we're dying. We need help.
Wow. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more of the local news roundup. I want you to know, internationally speaking, that Nick Oxner is drinking Earl Grey tea out of a Chinese cup. So it's very international today. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Nick Oxner's here from WBTV News. Joe Bruno from Channel 9, WSOC-TV. Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal. And Glenn Birkins, founder and publisher of QCityMetro.com. The governor announced another new restriction. As he said, we're staying in phase two this week.
People must wear face coverings when in public places, indoors or outdoors, where physical distancing of 6 feet from other people who are not members of the same household or residence is not possible. They will be required for all employees and customers of retail businesses and restaurants, as well as workers in manufacturing, construction, meat processing, and agriculture settings.
Wearing or not wearing face masks has become, as we've said, a political issue and one about which health officials and a lot of politicians have been reluctant to mandate. But Mayor Vi Lyles requested the governor to include a face mask mandate this week. And in making the announcement, the governor echoed medical experts.
Overwhelming evidence that is growing by the week shows that wearing a face covering can greatly reduce the spread of COVID-19, especially from people who have it and don't know it yet. Face coverings are a simple way to control this virus while protecting ourselves, our families, and the other people around us.
So this goes into effect at 5 p.m. tonight, 5 p.m. Friday, for those of you listening on Saturday morning. We joined, I think, 17 other states now in mandating face masks. How's this going to be enforced?
Well, it was interesting. I mean, it's not. I mean, one of the things that was really interesting is the governor said point blank, the responsibility, the onus is really on businesses to enforce it both with their employees and with customers. There's not any kind of what's the executive order say, Nick? It's something like there's no criminal prosecution.
Yeah, the executive order goes out of its way to say no individual should be fined or face a criminal penalty.
Well, here's what the governor said about compliance.
The responsibility here is on the businesses and the organizations to make sure that their employees and their customers wear these face coverings. And that is where law enforcement can make their citations.
But here's an inconsistency. Police officers, it will not be authorized to criminally enforce the mask requirement, but they can issue citations. What would the penalty be if they issue a citation to you?
Trespassing, I think, was what the governor mentioned. And he raised the prospect of some others. He also said during the same media briefing that this would be on the honor system in essence. So again, this really falls in the laps of business owners, and business owners are already concerned by business that's been lost, the hesitancy of people to come back into stores. So this does create some headaches for store managers, store employees, and the people who own the businesses.
And Joe, we should note as well that a CMPD official has said that they don't anticipate stopping individuals on the streets who aren't wearing masks issuing citations. So as has already been said, a lot of this is just going to be voluntary compliance.
Here's the honor system in practice. Chris Teeter is going to require masks. They're hoping that people wear masks into their stores. If an employee sees someone without a mask, they're going to approach that person, inform them of the order, and then offer them a mask. If that person declines, that's that. They're not going to ask for any proof of exemption. They're just going to assume that that person has a reason why they are not wearing the mask. They're not going to ask that person to leave. They're not going to escalate it any further. That's what the system looks like.
And there's another problem with this. WBTV is reporting that it doesn't cover everywhere in public. The executive order requires wearing face mask coverings, makes them mandatory in almost any business or retail setting, but does not include language in the order itself that requires them at public places like parks. And evidently the restrictions the governor spoke about in the clips you just heard are not written in the executive order. What have you heard from the governor's office about that?
Not much. And it's my colleague David Hodges who did that story. When you listen to the language from the governor at his press conference on Wednesday, it was, when you're out of your house, wear a mask. I'm paraphrasing, but it was everywhere, you should wear a mask. But when you read the text of the executive order, as Eric was just talking about, it's business based. So there's nothing to say. And so David talked to County Commissioner Mark Durrell, who said, look, I have a concern that this doesn't actually cover wearing a mask at a mass gathering, a protest, a outdoor concert. I mean, because these are arguably not businesses. And the governor's office just kind of got back to him and said, no, that means everywhere. And despite the text of the order that doesn't say that.
Well, is it just a bad, go ahead, Eric.
I was just gonna say one thing that's interesting, Mike, is so we had this week, the county commissioners meeting, they vote 7-2 to create a more stringent version of this, anticipating what the governor is going to do. Trevor Fuller in particular saying, look, we have specific needs in Mecklenburg County with a denser population. We need to do something that is more restrictive. And then after the governor makes his announcement, the county commissioners decide, no, we're not going to do anything. We'll just let the governor's orders stand and not take any further action. So I just thought that was kind of a curious turn of events
given that this is a public health issue and this is not a business issue, this is a public health issue. Explain to me why politicians, policymakers, so-called leaders won't take the lead on this. They want to throw it off onto the backs of businesses who have their own problems to deal with. Why is it not? And I asked Gibby Harris this question. I don't think she gave me a good answer, but why is it not irresponsible on the part of public health officials not to be beating the walls with this, please issue a mandate? Why have they not been doing that?
Yeah, I mean,
if it's so important that we wear masks, why aren't they screaming this from the rooftops? Because it's sending a mixed message.
Well, I think a lot of it, Mike, as I'm sure you know, has to do with politics. No, it's difficult to tell people who don't want to wear a mask that you absolutely must wear a mask. And I mean, that's just...
Well, if it truly is a matter of public health, and if it truly helps, as the public health officials are telling us that it does, it's one of our few defenses on this, then I would say that you shouldn't be in politics and you shouldn't be in office if you can't take a leadership role, period. Either do it
Mike,
or don't.
Have you ever known any politician in North Carolina to have the intestinal fortitude to do the right thing?
You asked earlier why Europe was able to get control of this virus much faster than we have in the United States. I think you've answered part of that question there. Our culture here is just simply different. As a people, we're just simply much more rebellious and much more stubborn. We don't want to be told what to do.
Joe.
And it's interesting, though, isn't it, Glenn, that now the whole push for this is, in essence, peer pressure. I mean, they're talking about campaigns and having athletes and other sort of notable people encourage you to wear a mask. So it's almost as though we're not going to enforce it. We're just going to really, really plead with you to do it.
Yes, Joe.
Look at New Jersey. They've required masks for months now, and their cases are on the decline. They're banning travel from us or requiring us to quarantine now. The tables have turned. They got their act together up in Jersey and New York. We're the ones that are struggling. And maybe a mask mandate, the delay on that mandate did play some sort of role in that.
Yeah, you know, the U.S. is doing so poorly that they're in the European Union thinking of banning travel from the United States to the European Union. And as I mentioned in the opening, if you live here in North or South Carolina and you're planning to travel to New York or New Jersey or Connecticut, you will have to self-quarantine there for 14 days because they don't want you bringing it back to them. They just kind of put the kibosh on it. And the fines for disobeying that run $2,000 to $10,000 per person. I'm not sure how you enforce that or how you know unless you're coming in on an airplane at LaGuardia. I'm not sure how you know that, but we'll see. We mentioned that the CMPD is not going to be enforcing this in terms of putting you in jail. They might cite you. I think there are, four counties or more where the sheriff's departments are saying they're not going to enforce the governor's mask order. Halifax, Sampson, Craven, Iredell, and others are saying that. And the Sampson County Sheriff, Nick, Jimmy Thornton, says he believes Cooper's executive order mandating face coverings is not only unconstitutional, but unenforceable. How rare is it for sheriffs to legislate from the badge? Nick, this is WBTV story. So how unusual is that?
Look, this is really just sheriffs saying out loud the things they do every day in all law enforcement, right? You can pick and choose what you want to enforce. Okay. And this is, in this case, a bunch of sheriffs who largely are the most powerful people in many of their counties, especially the smaller town you get to, choosing to use their position to make a political statement. So, I mean, the thing is, there is an argument to be made that this is murky, right? We just talked about where does it actually apply? You can have an exception. So, you know, the governor's language in the executive order gave enough plausible deniability that they can hide behind it's hard to enforce. But at the same time, you know, I didn't know we had so many sheriffs that were constitutional scholars.
So, Joe, what are these rules? As I don't know whether they're written in the order or not, what do we think these rules are for people wearing masks? And is there any definition on what constitutes a mask? Because if I'm a person who doesn't want to wear a mask, I might go out there with a piece of Kleenex on my nose and say, that's my mask.
You might be able to get away with a Kleenex as an acceptable face covering. When we talk about this mandate here, it's not just, you know, the mask that you would expect to see in a doctor's office. Really, we're talking about any piece of cloth that can wrap around your lower face and cover the nose and mouth. In the order, it even says, like, you can use a T-shirt or a towel or a scarf if you have to.
And children under 11, I'm told, are exempted from this. Why? Can't they catch and or spread this disease?
They're exempt from it, but really the order also says masks should only not be worn if you are 2 and under. So it's not like kids under 11 aren't allowed to wear masks.
Yeah, it's still recommended.
Required. Yeah.
And what makes it unenforceable? We keep hearing politicians and now the sheriff saying it's unenforceable. What makes it unenforceable? They make you wear a seatbelt. They make you wear a helmet. They make you do all kinds of things that people don't want to do. And they enforce those laws. What makes this one unenforceable?
Because, again, it's that gray area of there are a list of exemptions that's on the honor system. So you don't have to prove your exemption. The enforceability by the language of this executive order would be on the business or establishment, not on the individual person. The governor is saying, you know, you need to wear it everywhere, but the text of the order says you only need to wear it indoors. This is a confusing labyrinth. If you're the guy trying to say you broke the law, there's a confusing contours of the law.
How much
Nick, you couldn't go ahead. Go ahead, Mike.
I'm just going to ask, how much of the confusion that seems to be surrounding almost every aspect of how we combat this disease is simply because we've never been through anything like this before in modern times, and how much of it is incompetence, and how much of it is political, tied up in politics?
Well, the governor's written an executive order before, and I'm going to guess it was written by a lawyer, so they could have written more clear language to the very specific issue of an executive order in the gray areas. But at the same time, you might suspect that this was written in such a narrow way on purpose. So that goes back to your other questions.
Well, and also, we've had, you see these historical news clippings. We've had fights during the Spanish flu, that pandemic, there were fights about wearing face coverings and what you could and couldn't do. So I think this goes to Glenn's point about there is culturally something about Americans that makes us resistant to follow public health orders.
So I'm not sure how they determined this, but researchers say wearing face masks in public prevented between 230,000 and 450,000 new cases of COVID-19 during a 5-week period this spring. So now face coverings, theoretically speaking, have to be worn inside and outside under this order, with a few exceptions. And hear what the governor said about those exceptions.
You can go outside and exercise and walk as long as you're not within 6 feet of other people without a mask. But public places, we want people to do this. As we said, the science is overwhelming.
Another inconsistency. The mandate says you have to wear a mask on public transportation, but no customer will be removed from mass transit for not being wearing a mask, and no one will be denied entry into a bus or a train without wearing a mask. The governor just said the science is overwhelming. What the hell is wrong with us?
The other thing we've seen about trying to enforce these, Mike, is in retail stores where they have tried to enforce it, people have actually become violent. They've attacked store employees. This is a very tough thing to actually put in place and put real teeth behind. Not only are you calling on law enforcement to enforce it, but you're calling on store clerks, you're calling on servers, you're calling on train operators, whomever, people who are not paid to be confrontational. And so all of that plays into these decisions. How much teeth are we going to put into this? You don't want to endanger workers who would to enforce that.
That has been the concern of the retail merchants from the beginning of this pandemic. As we've been saying, the burden is on businesses to enforce this order. And deeper, it's on the employees of those businesses, which includes 16-year-olds who are on high school break trying to convince people to wear masks that they have no intention of putting on.
And to the Mike, your point about the political aspect of this, there's so many political aspects. But one is, you know, as soon as the governor announced this the other day, Senate President Phil Berger came out with a statement talking about the protests and how there were obviously large groups of people, many of them not wearing masks. And so every step you take during this, there is always sort of this back and forth punch, counterpunch with the political dimension that gets in the way of the public health conversation.
And in fact, Phil Berger, the Senate leader in Raleigh, a Republican, said that the science that Roy Cooper has been following is, quote, political science, end quote. So he's making this a Democrat-Republican issue. Maybe we're spending too much time talking about people not wanting to wear masks, because I think maybe more people are going to wear them than not. Would you say that might be true?
I think that's true. I do think more people than not will wear them. I think the real question, and maybe health experts have answered this, I just haven't seen it, is that enough? If you have 55, 60% or whatever the number ends up being, is that enough to make a real difference? Or do you need 75, 80, 90% before you make that impact?
Well, we'll finish up our little conversation here about the phase three delay and masks, but then we'll move on to other things. There was a deadly block party on Beatty's Ford Road this past week, and we'll talk about that when we come back as well. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Joe Bruno's here from WSSC-TV, Channel 9, Glenn Birkins, QCityMetro.com, Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, and Nick Oxner, the investigative executive producer at WBTV. Before we move on, unless something changes between now and the start of school, students, teachers, and staff will be required, I'm told, to wear masks while on school grounds, but they are not requiring them at elementary schools. That's merely encouraged there. Does that mean the students are not required to wear them, or that teachers, faculty, and staff are not made to wear them at elementary schools as well? Who knows the answer to that? We need Ann Doss Helms here. Nobody knows the answer.
The governor's expecting to release more guidance on schools next week.
Okay. And there's a question about hospitals, because, you know, a couple of months ago we were talking about the Atrium and Novant setting up some sort of a satellite hospital to handle the influx of emergency room patients should this get out of hand. And then they decided that it wasn't going to get out of hand, and they canceled those plans. Is that still the case? We have these rising number of hospitalizations and rising number of cases. Is that still the case?
You know, Mike, we did a statewide survey of hospitals with our local reporting network this week that found in the 3 months, really since the pandemic began, hospitals have been able to make a number of changes and drastically increase their capacity. Our survey included response from Novant, which said they've increased capacity by 60% across their health system. Interestingly, Atrium.
How have they done that?
a number of different ways. One, by changing some rooms to have like more negative pressure rooms, which you need when treating COVID. They've now had time to order more PPE to shift staffing around. They've also, the most interesting thing to me is the hospital association in the state has found a way to order PPE for all of its members so that the small hospitals can get access to the same bulk of PPE that the larger hospitals can. Mm-hmm. There's a shipment of 36,000 gowns, for instance, from Turkey sitting in U.S. Customs right now that's bound for North Carolina's shores here next week. And so the hospitals say that they, because of the stay-at-home order that shrunk the number of hospitalizations a couple months ago, they're much better prepared now. And there doesn't appear to be an imminent threat of running out of capacity, but they're eyeing the upward trend wearily.
So moving on to other news, there was a very disturbing event that happened shortly after midnight on Monday on the West Side during what has been billed as an extension of a Juneteenth celebration. A block party near Bates Ford Road erupted in gunfire. Listen to this.
Damn. Damn, come straight back.
The popping sounds, gunfire mixed in with automatic weapons fire. The gunfire went on for about 32 seconds. First reports say about 100 rounds were fired, but police accounted for 181 shell casings from both handguns and rifles. What happened at this party?
I guess first thing I would say, Mike, is that particular audio, I've heard others, that particular audio does not do justice to the horror that the people who were there experienced. Just the sheer number of rounds that were fired, and the rapidity, it was such a deadly encounter. Police are still trying to figure out exactly what happened. A fourth person died. We know that four people total have died. One died, police informed us this week, after being hit by a car while trying to escape the carnage. We initially thought that all died from gunshot wounds. Three died from gunshot wounds. One died after being struck by a car. They're still trying to piece together what happened. I asked during a press briefing this week whether this was a case of rival groups firing at each other and innocent people being caught in the crossfire, or whether this was a case of someone actually firing into the crowd with intent. And they said they didn't know. They said they need the public, people with video in particular. And they emphasized, you might think your video shows nothing. You might think your account is insignificant, but any video, any account of what happens can help CMPD piece together what actually happened and hopefully lead to some arrests.
And several people on the scene said this literally came out of nowhere. That was their impression as they were at this party and suddenly the gunshots ran out. They told reporters that everybody was getting along. There was no arguing. There was no confusion until the moment the shots were fired.
It was definitely unnerving. It sounded like a battlefield, honestly, to be honest. And it was just, like I said, complete chaos. People running everywhere, cars moving everywhere. Like I said, they took a celebration and turned it into chaos.
Interestingly enough, CMPD was already on the scene prior to the first shot being fired because somebody had been, I think, struck by a car and they were there to deal with that. No police shot any of their, no gunfire came from police. They did not discharge any of their weapons. How helpful are people being in terms of getting information that the police might need to solve this to the police?
Earlier this week, they said 20 people had come forward, but they need many more. There were an estimated 400 people at this street party. as of earlier this week, only about 20 had come forward with videos or accounts of what happened. CMPD has names. They've heard names mentioned, but in terms of calling them suspects, they were at that point, they were reluctant to say that they were suspects. One of the interesting things that came out this week is they believe that some of these guns, based on ballistic analysis, may have been used in crimes, other crimes in this area. Hmm. They would not talk about that at all, but they said they found reason to believe that some of these guns had been used before in violent crimes.
Well, this is also the week that CMPD Chief Kerr Putney announced his retirement. He had wanted to retire at the first of the year, come back for the convention, and then retire again. That didn't work out, so he stayed on. But now the convention is not coming, and so this time around, he announced his retirement for real.
The RNC is not coming in the capacity that we thought. And to be quite frank with you, I can control my own destiny, and that's exactly what I'm doing.
Is it my imagination, or does his tone and his choice of words indicate there might be something more behind this? Silence.
A dead silence falls on the ground.
Yeah. Well, we knew this was coming. We just didn't know exactly.
They have his replacement. It's a known commodity, and, you know, he doesn't have to be here for the RNC, and the timing is right.
And he's described his experience, as his time as chief, as, quote, interesting. did he do any other reflecting?
He wasn't very reflective. He made several comments that there would be a time later to be more reflective about what he's seen and what he's experienced in this time. And he also said that beyond doing some consulting with law enforcement, he plans to be much more outspoken on some community issues, working to build trust between particularly younger people and the police. So it sounds like he has a lot more to say. He just didn't want to say it this week.
Well, actually, in several of his many visits to this program, he actually said a lot more than I thought was normal for a public official, a chief of police. And you could tell there was a lot of frustration. And just to underline what you just said, Eric, he does, I think, plan to speak out more.
I have a voice that you're going to hear more of. So this is not goodbye. This is just finishing one chapter, one phase, going into the next. And I might even be more vocal in the next.
Hmm. The new chief will be Assistant Chief Johnny Jennings. What do we know about him? He's been on the force for a long time.
Yeah, he has a lot of experience. He's been tasked with leading some of Charlotte's biggest events. He was immensely involved with the DNC, the NBA All-Star Game, Billy Graham's funeral. Certainly, he has the resume that has prepared him for this role.
And that incoming chief, Johnny Jennings, will be on this program on Thursday of next week. So we'll do an entrance interview, I suppose, with him. The protests in the streets following the killing of George Floyd are moving change, I think, faster than a lot of people thought would be possible after decades of calls for Confederate monuments and memorials to come down. Now they are coming down. And the Confederate flag has been banned, as we know, from all NASCAR facilities and races. We've seen name changes be asked for in all kinds of places, including at CMS. It started with the announcement that Vance High School, named for Zebulon Vance, a former governor here, might get a name change. It will, and the school board says they're looking to rename all schools with ties to slavery or racism. How many schools would fall into that category?
Well, you know, I think we just need to take a look at who the schools are named after and why. I mean, there's a Barringer School. Which Barringer is that tied to? J.M. Alexander. There's a lot of, they have to do a lot of studying on these people's history and backgrounds to make sure that they align with what they want to present to students and parents in the 21st century.
Usually when you try to change anything about a high school, it evokes a lot of emotion in students and parents and alumni, because high school is a particular time of life where you kind of attach yourself to your mascot and your school spirit and whatever high school you went to. There doesn't seem to be a lot of pushback on changing the name of Vance High School, Glenn. How do you explain that?
I don't know how to explain that. I think part of the reason might be that a lot of people really don't know the history of the name of that school or the history of Vance. I think that could be part of it. A lot of the focus has been on the Confederate monuments that were erected to people who fought to divide the Union, fought to preserve slavery. And I think, a governor who pushed for education or, you know, may have had a kind of a checkered past, that may not rise to the same level.
Speaking of monuments coming down, crews in Raleigh removed the remnants of a 75-foot-tall Confederate monument that stood on the State House grounds or near the State House grounds for 125 years. That monument was removed by order of the governor in the interest of public safety because citizens had already attempted to remove it themselves. Is there a law in place still that requires, I think, the legislature to get involved in any of these monuments being removed?
Yeah, that law was passed in 2015, wasn't it, Nick? Wasn't it McCrory era?
Yes.
So this removal for public safety reasons could be merely temporary, or once they're gone, do you think they'll ever come back?
Oh, I don't think they'll ever come back. That was the auspices under which they were removed by the governor this week.
And in the city of Wilmington, also for safety reasons, they took down some statues in their downtown area and moved them to an undisclosed location. They described that removal as temporary and in accordance with state law. Same question. Will it be different if a city does it versus the governor?
I think it applies equally to everybody, I think.
You know, what's interesting, Mike, is, you know, cities and counties are taking action on their monuments right now, even though that law is in place, but there just doesn't seem to be appetite right now with Mecklenburg County taking action on their Confederate monuments. I specifically asked a couple leaders about the monument that sits out near Memorial Stadium that, if you remember, a couple of years ago, it was vandalized repeatedly, mm-hmm. and paid money to protect it. And they're citing that law as a reason why they are not taking any action on it right now. I also will say, though, I drove by that monument a couple days ago just to see what it looked like, the state of it. And, you know, it's still covered in that glass, but there wasn't any vandalism at all. If anything, it needs to be washed because the construction dirt is just covering the plexiglass. It seems like a lot of people have forgotten about it.
And, of course, in Charleston,
where they are. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Mike, it's also interesting that commission that the mayor formed at the behest of Larkin Eggleston. You know, there's some pushback from the local NAACP in terms of who makes these decisions on renaming, what's renamed, how it's renamed. So it sounds like we're going to have a broader community conversation about this.
And Mike,
disturbing thing happened in Wilmington. In addition to the statue, we're talking about the three police officers who were fired this week over racist rants captured on video. Among other things, one of the officers said, "We're just going to go out and start slaughtering them," meaning African Americans. "I can't wait," he said. "God, I can't wait. A civil war is needed to wipe them off the expletive map." That just scratches the surface. So bad apples. Evidence of inherent racism evidence that the police department there has been infiltrated by white supremacists. What do we think this is?
Probably a little of all of the above. One of the points that I want to make when we're talking about removing monuments, and I've said this on this show before, even though these are emotional issues for a lot of people and they have strong symbolism, removing of monuments is not the end. That's not why people are protesting in the streets. We need real change. We need police reform.
Okay. We have to leave it there. We have so much more we could talk about, but we have to leave it there, and we will. Nick Oxner joined us today, WBTV News, Joe Bruno from WSOC TV News, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, and Eric Spanberg with the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for the hour. Appreciate it. Stay safe. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.